Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here as always with my friend and my colleague and my co-host, Ross Ferguson.
I'm really proud of you. You got through that whole thing without having like a moment to yourself there.
You know, I did almost get tripped up because I've mentioned this before. I get hung up on the Midwestern.
Yes.
I pronounce it Midwestern.
Yeah.
And so this time I intentionally said mid. But as soon as I make myself intentionally do something, my brain trails off and I don't know what I'm going to say next. So I can't multitask.
Maybe you should can that and just do like an intro that is the same every time.
Yeah, but if we did that, we wouldn't have these fun moments of last time where I lost train of thought and thought it was a gospel-centered ministry and not a gospel-centered resource.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then I say resource different and we've had
resource.
We've had a review on this. Why does Ross say resource?
Resource. Hey, you seen any good movies lately? Other than Babette's Feast?
Babette's Feast. Do you know what? We're not really watching movies in the minute because
Okay, go ahead. Sorry. I just thought of something. I'm really excited about it. It involves your family. But anyway, go ahead.
Jared's brain just went somewhere else.
Sorry.
We have been watching Frasier.
Oh, interesting.
From the beginning. So we're just actually a few episodes from finishing the entire series again. So actually, as a couple, we've never watched the whole thing all the way through. So this is us just coming towards the end of season 11, and then we're going to watch the new Frasier that's just released.
Okay.
The kind of like the updated version, new episodes. So yeah, that's kind of what we've been really watching for a little while now.
I've seen episodes here and there, but I've never watched the show.
It's actually way more funny than I was expecting.
Wow.
So
okay. The juxtaposition. the juxtaposition in Frasier of the dad and his sons.
Yes.
I always thought that was funny.
Yes.
That he's such like
it's very funny.
This grizzled cop and they're like these dandies.
Yeah.
Here's what I'm excited about. Okay. I just thought about it. There's a new Minions movie coming out.
Despicable Me 4.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And when I saw the preview for it, Becky and I went and saw Kung Fu Panda last weekend. And the previews are just going to be for kids' movies. So I was kind of bummed out because I want to see previews for grown-up movies, even though we're seeing Kung Fu Panda. And Despicable Me 4 preview, and I was like, we saw Minions with you and your girls.
Yes.
And I thought, we need to go see Despicable Me 4 with the Fergusons.
That's what we need to do.
That will make it enjoyable.
Do you know our girls still talk about two things from that trip that we did to the theater with you guys?
Oh, yeah.
Number one, one of our girls really needed to go and use the restroom. And we said,
you said no one could get up.
We said no one can get up. 10 minutes later, Jared gets up and goes out. And I have a kid looking down the row going, how does he get to go out? And I'm like, because Jared's his own man. He can figure it out. And then the second thing, right at the end of the film, there's like a singing scene.
Yes,
and it's like the whole
the
choir.
Part.
You like split laughter. And the girl's just like, Jared's really laughing at this. I think they didn't know that you laughed.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it was just like the comments have always revolved around those two things. Jared gets to do what he wants and he laughs at Minions.
Those are good rules for life. Those are good rules for my household. Jared gets to do what he wants.
But yeah, we should do that. The girls actually were really excited that the fourth one's coming out. I'm like, a fourth one?
I'm always curious about children's perceptions of me. I think they see me as kind of a grumpy person, and I think I am kind of a grumpy person.
That might
but
be why.
Last couple weekends ago, little Rose Kester drew pictures for Becky and for me. She drew us each a picture, and she came, and the contrast in these pictures is so amazing and so telling. And to me, it was like it was a window into how little Rose pictures us. Becky's was colored, so it's all colorful and had these designs.
Bright, nice.
And it was like a stick figure handing flowers to another stick figure. And it had this whole 5-line prose poem.
Wow.
And it was like a love letter to Becky. It was like, every child who knows you knows that you are, loving and kind.
Yeah.
And it was so flowery and so eloquent. Mine was a black and white.
Yeah.
It was a drawing of me. A little more fleshed out than stick figures, so I was appreciative of that. I had glasses and a checkered shirt or something on. It was a fleshed out picture of me holding a microphone. I guess I'm preaching. And there was a word bubble that came out, and it just said, so, and that's all it said. And I was like, I'm the so-um guy.
You're the so-um guy.
Becky is the children flock to you because of your natural you know, beauty and so caring nature. And Jared is so it was really cool. It was funny, but I was like, oh, this is like they say you're the Disney princess, and I'm you know, Eeyore, I guess. I don't know.
I was going to say the Beast, but
I'll take that. I like the Beast. He was studly. All right, this is a mailbag episode. We haven't done one of these in a while.
We haven't for a while.
People probably been missing these.
Yeah.
We have an email address now.
We do.
I cannot access it.
No.
So Ross is in control of what emails I even see.
Let's just say it's not that Jared can't access it. It's that Jared has no idea how to access it.
You told me how. It does not. I'll show you on my computer if you think that I'm making this up.
It works for me, folks.
It does not work for me. Exactly what you said to do. Doesn't appear. So Ross sees the emails and he sends me probably selectively. There's probably some good emails in there about how I'm awesome and stuff. And he's like, I'm not going to show Jared this. So anyway, we've got a new, what's the email address? People do want an email.
Do you not even know the email address?
No, well, I can't check it. How would I even know what it is?
mailbag@ftc.co. And .co is CO. So mailbag@ftc.co. Right.
So, okay. So in the future, if you want to send us a question, and you don't have to wait for me to put it out on social media, that's been the hang up is I'll put out, hey, what are some questions or topics? And this way you can do it round the clock. You can just send an email to mailbag@ftc.co.
That's it.
And Ross will screen it for appropriateness. But now we've got a good variety of questions from all over. This comes from James on Facebook. James says, when counseling, how do you discern when it's time to recommend that the individual seek out professional counseling from a biblical or Christian counselor? Are there any indications during the conversation that may tell you that the situation is beyond your capabilities as a pastor? Mm. There's a couple of things. I'll just be brief. A couple of things. One is, James, is a good question, and it's something I've thought through quite a bit, particularly in my last pastorate when I was doing a lot more pastoral counseling than I've done in this latest season. It was typically when people were dealing with things that I didn't have a whole lot of experience or training specifically in, especially as it relates to experience of abuse or maybe even addictions, chemical or drug addictions, things like that, that they were in recovery from or seeking help with. I didn't disengage as a pastoral counselor. That's not what I'm saying, that you just sort of hand off entirely. But I may want to bring in as a supplemental or maybe even as the more central voice with me sort of checking in and being in touch with the counselor, those who could speak into those areas. So we had in at my last church, we had in our area the New England affiliate office for CCEF, the Christian Counseling Education Foundation. And so, you know, trusted them, biblical counselors. They work with pastors. With the client's permission, we could share back and forth what the conversations were like. They know what the aims are for us as a church and as a pastor, and so we could work in concert. But they had training in some of these areas that I just don't have experience. So I can help people look at the scriptures, apply those. We can I can point them to Christ. I can encourage them, counsel them to the best of my ability. But when it was usually experiences that seemed a little bit outside of my expertise, experience, or training for some of those things, typically abuse and addictions, those were a couple of areas that I referred to those outside. And then another sort of instance would just be when I think somebody needs more ongoing help beyond the bandwidth that I would have. So let's say I'm meeting with somebody and we're going to meet once a week for the next 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever it is. At that point, I may think like, okay, I'm going to now scale back and meet with you every, couple of weeks or once a month. But you really should be meeting with somebody every week. Then I might refer to a counselor where they can meet with that person every week. What about you?
I'm pretty much exactly the same as that. I would just add maybe a couple of thoughts on it. Number one, don't hand people off. Bring people in because they're still your flock. So you still want to be guiding them. But one of the things I would say is I don't have a lot of experience of situations where I've gone, I can't really speak into this.
I got you. You're just an expert in everything.
I think there's just a part of me that often goes that I'm not there to solve their problems.
Oh, okay.
And so to some extent, there is a limit of what I can do. And I try to some extent, make that clear that actually that I'm not responsible for trying to get you off your, a substance that you're addicted to, or, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, I'm not responsible to recovering your marriage. There is a limit that I can go to. And I would be wary of like handing people off. I'd be just kind of going, if we can't get the fundamentals right, then actually the fundamentals, no matter who you speak to, you're going to struggle with. So I think there's just a part of me that I haven't had that experience. And the second thing I would say is ask yourself this question. What do you think that you can't do or can't advise on? And then spend some time skilling up in that area. So early on in my ministry, I hadn't done any funerals for the first few years. And so funerals were something that I kind of, somebody else could do that. Like the other elders could do that. And I just realized, like, you can't go through ministry and not do funerals. It's going to happen. And so I actually just went and talked to other pastors and said, how do I do this? How do I sit down with families? How do I hold my own emotions at bay? How do I help them? And I think to some extent for James that's asking this question, more often than not, people ask this question because something's come up. Like something's come up that they're feeling they can't handle. What is it that you can't handle? Is there a way that you can ask your church that you can have some training in that? So if you're in an area where there's a lot of addictions as an issue, could you do some addiction training and even go to some biblical counselors and skill up?
Sure.
So that you don't have to hand off as much. The one person I recall I did hand off is, it was like fairly major medical situations. And I just said, I can pray with you. I can help and guide you through how you handle this. But you do need to see a medical professional for this.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I think the key here is to say the scriptures are sufficient, but I am not.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, if you can, you know, get more training, get more experience in any of these areas so you become a better expert, I suppose, or more, you know, excellent in some of these areas, that's fine. But there's, even within the church,
yeah,
you know, if a couple is coming and experience a particular struggle in their marriage or something, certainly that doesn't mean like I can't speak into that.
Yeah.
Even if I don't have the experience, I can point them to the scriptures. I can counsel them as a pastor. But I may also be looking at, oh, there's another couple in the church that actually has this experience.
Yeah.
And you might be really helped by a mentoring relationship with them. So it's not necessarily that I'm like, I'm going to offload you. But there may be somebody who's better suited to disciple you than I am. And I don't mind saying that. It doesn't mean I'm not a, you know, it doesn't mean I'm a bad counselor if I think, oh, let me pair you with someone who has that experience.
Yeah.
Women counseling women, you know what I mean? If there's a woman who comes and says, you know, I was, you know, sexually abused by my father, or I'm struggling with this thing. As a pastor, I can encourage her in the scriptures. I can bring to bear the sufficiency of the word. But there may be a woman in the church who's been through that, has experienced healing, or just has followed Christ through that in a way that I think, you know, this person can help you in a way that I can't. They have an experience.
Yeah.
And so in a similar way, if there is a counselor or those, and again, it's not a, I'm going to have nothing to do with you now. I'm going to give you to the expert. But in conjunction with, and I would never refer to a Christian counselor who would not work with a pastor or would not work with a church's aims or even be outside of our theological convictions, those sorts of things. But there may be someone like, well, they have experience and training in a particular area that I don't. And I don't need to be, I don't need the feeling of me being sufficient.
Yeah.
As if they're using the word, and they have a level of excellence in this area that I do not, I don't mind saying, let's avail ourselves of a, you know, a gift that the Lord's given the church, perhaps in that area.
I think that's good.
This comes from Andy on Twitter. Andy says, is it reasonable? I love this question. Is it reasonable to have a defined dress code for those serving up front on Sunday mornings? Pastors, worship team, prayer leaders, etc. And if so, what should that code look like?
I think we might end up disagreeing on this.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think it would be reasonable. I don't think it's essential, but I think the question is it reasonable?
Oh,
I think it is.
I agree.
I think it's reasonable. I think for each church, it will look and be managed differently. I think the key context is modesty.
Yeah.
And what I say by modesty is not, you know, often we use the word modesty in relation to what women wear. What I'm saying with modesty is simply not drawing attention
to
yourself.
It's not distracting or overly so.
Yeah, exactly. This may be awkward for this podcast, but I have known church members that have said about their pastor, he wears too tight jeans and it's really distracting.
Interesting.
So there is a reality that modesty is just simply not drawing attention or distraction to yourself. When I pulpit supply, I will always ask the question, what would you like me to wear? Yep. What's the general dress of the room? And I usually go one up from what they say. So if they say, hey, jeans and a shirt, I'll probably put chinos on a shirt. If they say, hey, you can wear a suit, no need for a tie, I'll probably wear a tie. You know, I'll just go one up because I'm representing more often than not Midwestern Seminary. So I want to represent that. But the key thing for me is what fits your church. So I've preached in shorts and flip-flops. I've also preached in a suit. And it's what fit with that church. I was helped in a church plant in a really deprived area. A suit would just make no sense. At the same time, I served in a church that was kind of fairly middle class and most people wore suits. It made sense for me to wear a tie. Gotcha. So yes, it's reasonable. I think the code will look like what your church wears and maybe like one up from that. So if your church is hoodies and shorts, you might be hoodie and jeans. Do you know, like you'll be one up. Where we might disagree is I know you've worn like hoodies to preach and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can personally quite do that myself, but that's more a me thing, partly because I boil in a hoodie.
So it's distracting to you?
No.
Oh, okay.
I think if I wore a hoodie, it would be distracting to people, if that makes sense. I think people know me for wearing a shirt on Sunday. So I think if I suddenly wore a hoodie,
I don't think that it would ever have occurred to me.
I think people don't even think about what I wear on a Sunday.
Right. Well, that's close.
But to answer the question quite clearly, it's reasonable. I think set it to what your church seems right for your church, but just keep it modest.
You know, this is why, I mean, this is interesting. This is why vestments became a thing. Gowns, preaching gowns, choir gowns or choir robes, whatever you call them, preaching vestments. The idea originally was you're getting rid of any kind of class superiority or fancy dress. We're going to dress modestly and uniformly. Yep. This is the uniform. Over time, that became equated with sort of an ostentatiousness, high church, too formal. And so people began to dress down.
Yep.
So it's really funny that the vestments sort of go that route. At my last church, Rural Church of Vermont, I wore a tie on Easter once.
Yeah.
And they wore me out.
Yeah.
Even though it was Easter, I thought, you know, I'm going to dress up because it's Easter. Yeah. Maybe on Mother's Day or something. You know, blue collar folks, like they think, who are you trying to impress? If I dress nice, who are you trying to impress?
Yep.
I preached once we had a picnic afterwards, so I wouldn't do this on a normal Sunday, but I preached in a Celtics jersey one Sunday. Our church did not care. People came to church in overall. I mean, that was not the thing. Now, if you were like overly trying to draw attention to yourself with how casual, I mean, clearly there would be such a thing as too casual there, but people just came as they were. It was not a thing. And in fact, you would stand out if you tried to dress nice.
Yep.
In our current setting, I think people dress sort of business casual.
Yeah, we're
just casual to business casual. We have a few older folks who wear suits. Yeah. We have a few young people that will dress up, but it's kind of diverse.
Yeah, we're on towards that.
Yeah.
One of the things I would say is that, you know, the context is so important.
Yes, exactly.
When I served a church in North Dakota, everyone wore blue jeans to farm. So for me to wear blue jeans on a Sunday was like I'm bringing my farming clothes to church. So it was like I wore blue jeans once and I was told, like, don't do that because the context is correct. I wore blue jeans all the time in my church in the UK because that's just what people wore. So I think your context will dictate, but I think we're both saying reasonable, but you'll catch.
The question is it reasonable to have a defined dress code? The answer is yes. What should that code look like? It depends on your context, on your setting, but generally you want not just modesty in terms of, private parts the clothes aren't tight on private parts, but modesty in the sense of it's not distracting.
Yep.
Yeah. In any case, overly flamboyant, overly casual, et cetera, it depends on your context. Is that what we're saying?
Yep. Okay. That sounds good.
This comes from Darren on Facebook. Darren says, how do you make a small town church ready for the physical growth around it? For example, if a town of 3,500 is expected to grow to 6,000 by the end of the next year, what are some best practices to prepare the church for visitors and opportunities for outreach? You know, kind of, I added, included this question without really thinking about how we sort of talked about this a little bit, not exactly, but an episode, two episodes ago, when a church changes,
yeah,
we talked about leading a church to embrace change, adjust to change, accept change. What would you add, I guess, to that conversation? So what we would say is go back and listen to that episode. Yep. Plus
what this, we'll say here. A couple of things. Love your community well. So engage with new stores, new schools, new eateries. Like, just get out and about. Enjoy your community. If it's going to grow, be part of it. Second, train your congregation how to welcome people, how to initiate gospel conversations. Don't just assume that your church knows how to interact with the community. So they kind of go hand in hand. As you go out, this is what we will do as we go out. Pray. I've been in a community that's expanded quickly, and we used to do prayer walks, literally just walk the streets and pray for the people that would live in those houses. And then finally, I would say, remind your people that this is exactly what we have preached for, prepared for, prayed for, the expansion of this area so the kingdom can also be expanded. So love your community, train your church, pray for the community, and remind your people this is exactly what we want to see.
Yeah, remind them that these are the people that the Lord is sending into your area.
You're responsible for taking the gospel to
them. He's sending a mission field in some ways to your context. We should be grateful for that. Yeah, and just, yeah, remind them that loving people is more important than loving the things always staying the same, I suppose. All right, this comes from Andrew on Twitter. Andrew says, what does it look like for churches to transition from church plant to an established church? And I kind of rephrase this in my own head, which is basically, how do you know when a church plant, when is a church plant not a church plant anymore?
Yeah.
And there's a few sort of, I think, things you can look at. Somebody, you know, some folks will say church plant is a established church when has plurality of elders, is able to raise up leaders from within itself and add elders to itself. That's an important mile marker there. I think it's a little more cut and dry than this. It's not totally cut and dry. In my mind, a church plant is an established church when it can financially sustain itself.
Yeah.
When it doesn't need outside support as a church plant does. And for some churches, that may take a little longer than for others. But that's sort of the key characteristic I have. I don't know if you have something that you would add. Culturally, there's some things that
work itself out. I kind of said staffing. I said building, not necessarily your own building, but just an established location.
Okay.
But church plants can still have that. I think time just tells. Like, there comes a point where you don't say 45 years later, we're a church plant. Like, no, you're not. You've been there for 45 years.
Yeah.
One of the things I would just say is maybe not just on when you know the transition's happened, but I would be slow to make the jump mentally from, oh, we're now an established church, because there's an element of church planting that is excellent for all churches.
Yeah.
And that is that desire to go out, share the community with the gospel. There's a certain sense of urgency. There's also a sense of we're all in this together. Who cares about the building? Who cares about where we meet? And an established church, it tends to be we care about where we meet. We care about the building. We have a lot of people to look after, so we can't go out as much. I would just kind of say, rather than what does it look like for it to happen, my argument kind of pushback would be, why do we want it to be established? And there's an element of good things, you know, a good ministry in the area. Just don't throw out everything to become established.
Yeah.
Actually, a church planting mentality, we did this recently at Liberty, where we went to bring an all church service together. We went to the local school to do it. I loved that because there was that sense of we're in the community. Yeah. The building's not really working for us, but we'll make it work. The gospel will still be preached. Yep. There's just that weird sense of excitement that comes from a church plant. You can get church plant fatigue with that, where you just kind of go like, we really would love a building.
That would be my caution.
We would really love to have this. So I think it's that fine balance of keep the mentality of a church plant, but bring in the security of an established church. That kind of mix. Yeah. When that happens, I don't really know. I don't even know how we do that, but I think that would be my aim.
Yeah, that's good. This comes from Nathaniel on Facebook. Nathaniel asks, is the age of accountability consistent with Scripture? Which is an interesting question. It's different than saying, is the age of accountability in Scripture?
Yes.
Which is how I originally read the question. And the answer to that is no. But is the age of accountability consistent with Scripture? And I think it depends on a couple of things. It depends on how you define age of accountability, first of all. The idea that, so let's just, I'll give you the idea that I think is inconsistent with scripture, it's unbiblical, that people are born as a blank slate of some kind, morally neutral or morally good, and then there is an age at which, and it may be, you know, different for every person, for every kid, but there's an age at which, or maybe it's uniform, somehow the guilt of of sin, the original sin kicks in.
Yeah.
It's when they become culpable that, and it kicks in at that point. That idea is foreign to scripture. Every person is born in iniquity was I conceived. Every person is born in original sin. The question, I think, though, is more along the lines of, are those who die in infancy or die at a young age before they are able to make a conscious profession of faith or able to make a conscious decision stemming from their sin, a willful sin, would they be saved? And I think we have a reasonable hope that there is something, I wouldn't call it age of accountability, but there is—
There's a grace.
That there's a grace for those who are not able to willfully act from their
brings in disabilities as well, those with severe disabilities. Agree. The one thing I would say, Isaiah 7 and verse 15 and 16, to go to your first point, it says, by the time he learns to reject what is bad and choose what is good, before the boy knows to reject what is bad and choose what is good, it always starts with the he knows what is bad and he has to learn the moment to reject what is bad and go to good. So actually the starting place is badness.
Mm-hmm.
And the accountability is when you know the ability to reject it. Mm-hmm. Like there is that moment. Scripture's silent on the age.
Yeah.
Scripture doesn't tell us the age, but it does hint towards there is a moment where you can reject what is bad and turn to what is good.
Yeah.
When that occurs, if it can occur, I'm thinking of some folks with disabilities. Scripture is silent on that.
Yeah, Second Samuel, where we have the story where David, his hope, when he's told that the child that he has conceived with Bathsheba is going to be taken, his hope, he says, I will go to him.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's, a few ways you could interpret that, but some see that's a hope of like, this child will be in paradise. And so I'm going to join him in paradise. That's a comfort to him. And so some take from that idea or from that there's a reasonable hope. I think there's some other places as well. I would recommend just along these lines, and I don't even know if any of this is getting exactly at what Nathaniel's asking, but there's a little book that Ronald Nash wrote, I mean, more than 20 years ago, called When a Baby Dies.
Hmm.
And he wrote it out of a pastoral comfort to couples dealing with the loss of children, the death of infants and others. And Nash's argument, which I found quite convincing and biblical, he gives a biblical theological argument. And it's not a long book, but it's written as a comfort for grieving parents. And essentially his argument is that children who die in infancy and those who are mentally disabled, some who are mentally disabled, are elect.
Yeah.
So he's coming from a reform perspective.
Yep.
And the natural pushback or the immediate pushback is to say, that means every person is born elect? No. Those who die in infancy.
Yeah.
And so he would say, the Lord knows who's going to die in infancy or those who are mentally unable to make, you know, willful, conscious choices. And he elects them unto salvation. And he makes a biblical case for that, which, you know, it's not airtight, I guess, but it gives us a reasonable hope, I think. And in that sense, age of accountability, I think, is a thing. An idea consistent with scripture, but there is no like, well,
this
the,
age for
the
this.
Children are brought and presented in the temple at age 12, therefore it's 12 is the age of accountability. Would you agree with
that? I think you're spot on there.
Okay. This comes from CJ on Facebook. CJ asks a very interesting question. What's the best thing? We complain a lot about the church in America and other places. What's the best thing the church in America has going for it?
I have two things.
Oh,
I have
two. Things. Whoa.
Two things.
You want to rank them one and two?
Yeah, I'll rank them one and two. Number one.
All right.
Resources.
Okay.
Car parking, buildings, money.
Okay.
Resources. I don't think the American church is aware of how much they have. And you only know it till you've been somewhere where they don't have it.
Okay.
So just even in the UK, church buildings are really hard to come by.
Yep.
Very, very expensive to run. Very old. Most churches have problems with their buildings. Next to no churches will have car parking and resources like that. The church sizes comparison to the States, will have a much lower budget than American churches. So I think number one, American church has a wonderful opportunity with the resources they have. Wonderful opportunity. I think sadly, sometimes they fight over it quite a lot, but yeah. I think there's just this wonderful that you have building, land, resources, books. It's like coming out of your ears in terms of how much you have. And it's I think the trick is how to use what you have. I think the British church does a lot with very little. And I wonder how much more American churches could do with all the resources. So I think that's number one as best resource. And then I think number two is young men. There is an incredible amount of young men in the American churches that I've visited, even rural churches, to have men. And I'll say rural churches tend to be like 40 to 60 year old men. You know, city-based churches, a lot of kind of 20 to 40 year old men. Young men, an incredible thing that American church has. Again, in the UK, not a lot of people training for pastoral ministry. Most rural churches will have the highest attendance is older women. And actually there is a huge lack of men to be able to run churches. And actually the egalitarian move, so to speak, in the UK is much stronger than the US. And it's because there's just a lack of young men in the church. And for me here, like just even Liberty's unusual because we're in a seminary town, but I look around, we've got like 40 young men and 35 of them could teach. And I'm coming from a context where if I could just have two, that would be such a blessing.
Yeah,
so I think resources and young men, I think, are the best thing that American churches have for what it's going for. And I want to be just really clear if you listen to this, I'm not saying young men are better than young women. I'm not saying that. I'm not making a gender issue here. I'm more going from the perspective of I've been in church situations nearly all my life where I'm going, where are the young men to be able to lead, to teach, to serve, to love, to marry, to just be? And I see that a lot more here.
Gotcha. The first thing I thought of was, so what makes American churches different? And the first thing I thought of was resources, money. But then I thought, no, that's not the best thing we have going for us because number one, I mean, it's an advantage, but we tend to misspend it. It becomes an idol. Mm. It leads to areas of comfort and consumerism that I don't think are advantages for us. So in some ways, we'd be a better advantage if we had poverty, maybe.
Whoa.
So I thought, okay, it's not that. When I think about the hope, what's the best thing we have going for us? I thought not just young men, just young people.
Yeah.
And in particular, this generation of young people. So I like where your head's at. You're right. Young men and leadership minded men and et cetera. But I'm just thinking of like the younger generation. Mm. I have so much hope for. They're so much further ahead than my generation. I'm a Gen Xer. You know, 30 years ago, my generation was just following the baby boomers into attractional, peer, you know, outdoing one another, kind of best practices, pragmatic. The younger generation I know of, they're sick of that.
Yeah.
So they want authenticity, but they want it in a way that is more looking at the past. So they're more historically rooted than previous young generations have been. They love the Bible more than young generations previously have, recent young generations have. And they're more missionally minded and less wedded to culture war and those sorts of things. So I'm broad brushing, but the question kind of calls for it. The best thing I think the church in America has going for it is a younger generation that really spells a positive future, I think.
And on your note on the resources, I think you're probably right. The best and worst thing that the American church has is the beauty of what they have, but not really realizing the beauty of what you have. You know, my last church, wonderful blessing to serve there. But if we had more resources and more young men, what would God do there? Mm. So
this comes from Jacob via email.
Via email. Hey. How do you know? You
this
don't know.
Came,
you
this can... came from Ross via Jacob or Jacob via Ross via email. Best resources. I've summarized this question. What's the best resources for training in gospel centrality? Jacob, this is a question that's so near and dear to my heart. Thank you so much for asking this question. If you're wanting to train people in your church towards the philosophy of gospel centrality, and I'm just going to throw four recommendations at you, two specifically and then two generally. The two specific ones, Ray Ortland's book, The Gospel. which is a little green book in the Nine Marks series, Building Healthy Churches series. How the Church Portrays the Beauty of Christ is the subtitle for that, the gospel. What's great about that little book, two things. Number one, you get the summation of not just the gospel, but how it impacts what a gospel-centered church should look like subjectively, what it should look like in terms of reflecting grace, what a gracious culture looks like, which is so much more important than simply having gospel centrality in paradigm or philosophy, is that you have it in the bloodstream. And Orland's book gets at that. But the second great thing about it is it's short and it's readable. It would be so much more, it would lend itself more easily to, like, you've got a group of leaders, teachers that you want to train. Hey, let's all read this book together, than if you're trying to hand them some gigantic manual of some kind. And in fact, you know, some of the other resources I recommend will be along those lines too. But it's short and readable. You can use it as a training book. We use it in our pastoral training center residency. But yeah, Orland's the gospel. Secondly, Trevin Wax has a book that no one ever talks about anymore for some reason. I don't know. He doesn't even mention it as far as I can see. It's an older book from Trevin Wax. It's called Gospel-Centered Teaching. I use this book with my children's ministry leaders, my children's Sunday school teachers at my last church. Short, it basically, Wax just walks through not just the principles of gospel centrality, but how do we teach the scriptures according to this philosophy. And it's written in plain English. It's not an academic book. It's great for, as you asked, for training. It was a great book to kind of get out into hands and have people kind of read through and we could discuss together, et cetera. It's called Gospel-Centered Teaching. And then generally, I'll recommend the works of Tim Keller and the works of Bob Thune. Keller, at kind of the 30,000-foot view, more academically, books like Center Church, maybe his curriculum, Gospel and Life. But you can look at some of the online resources and teaching resources for Keller. There's an online audio of his message, What is Gospel-Centered Ministry? His body of work, I think, you can pull bits and pieces. Okay, how do I apply gospel centrality and training in this area or this area, this area? Keller is sort of a one-stop shop for a catalog of gospel-centered application. And then Bob Thune has created, actually, not just these little books, but workbooks for training elders, deacons, and others within your church along gospel centrality. So if you want to see, like, what does it mean to have gospel-centered deacons and gospel-centered elders and those sorts of things, Bob Thune, who's a fellow Midwesterner, he's a pastor in Nebraska, he's created these essentially training manuals that you can use along these lines. So that's who I would recommend before I turn it over to Ross here. Ray Orland, Trevin Wax, Tim Keller, Bob Thune.
You know I'm not a massive fan of resources.
Okay.
So I think all of those.
But you're going to answer the question.
I'm
anyway.
Going to answer the question. I'm going to say two things. Number one, he won't say it, but Jared's books, he won't say it. But I've read your gospel-driven ministry, and there's also the gospel-driven church as well. Both of those, they're psychedelic colors. You'll see them.
Trippy.
But one of the things I was just going to say is immerse yourself in the gospel.
Yeah.
So I think one of the greatest resources you can have is the gospel itself. Now, I think Ray Ortland's book, The Gospel, does a great job of pulling it out.
Yeah.
But I think just immersing yourself in the gospel and then actually helping others see how that applies within scripture. And that's maybe where the resources kick in. But just, I think sometimes, and I think this is where I'm just a little bit wary, sometimes we can resource up, train up, and we're now gospel-centered because we've done these things. We're actually gospel-centered is the being immersed in the gospel, which then spills into everything that we do, the passages we preach, the ministries we run, the how we serve, even how we speak. So it sounds almost cliched, but don't replace the gospel with resources and don't
Sure.
replace scripture with the resources. Yes, have them. I think the ones you've mentioned, certainly two of those were on a list of mine. I think just make sure that they elevate the gospel that you're already immersing yourself in. You don't start with the book, start with the gospel. Don't start with the resource, start with scripture. And then use the resources in the books to kind of just elevate what you're already learning and immersing yourself in.
Gotcha.
So
you went spiritual, man.
Yeah.
I just took the question at face value.
Yeah.
What should I use to train my people?
I think the only reason I say that is because I think some young guys even working up, like, I want to be part of the gospel-centered movement.
I want to
read this book, do this training. Like, no, the gospel-centered movement is gospel-centered. So it can't be book or resource or conference-centered.
That's true.
It has to be gospel-centered.
That's true. All right, final question. This comes from Zeth via email.
From another email.
Another email. Interesting question. I thought this would be a fun one to end on.
I think we're going to disagree on this.
He initially asked, maybe, I don't know. He says, what do you think about The Chosen? What do you think about The Chosen? Which is, this is capital T, capital C. So he's talking about the television show or streaming show that aims to fictionalize or dramatize Christ in the Gospels.
I think you can answer this one first.
I'll tell you, I never think about The Chosen. Okay. I've never seen it.
Okay.
I'm not opposed to it per se. Yep. I don't have it doesn't violate my interpretation of the Ten Commandments.
Yep.
Some people oppose it on theological grounds. Just to say like this accounts to graven image. They don't want to see any image of Christ. Yep. So there's a lot of reform types that don't watch it for that reason.
Yep.
Others don't watch it because there's some controversies related to Mormon influence or broad evangelical influence and prosperity gospel types, or it's just not theologically informed by, you know, good theologians. Or I think there was even an LGBTQ controversy where there was a picture of from the set and there was a gay flag or something on the set at some point. I may be overstating that, but there was a controversy related to that. Some people oppose it for all those reasons. I watched The Passion of the Christ. It's from a Roman Catholic. Yep. Enjoyed that. I don't have a problem with it on a theological level. Culturally, I'm like, well, you know, anytime sinners make something about Jesus, it makes it sketchy.
Yep.
But that's not why I don't watch it. I just honestly don't care. The Jesus of the Bible is Jesus enough for me.
Oh.
I'm just telling you, some people like to this is a major devotional thing in their life. It's like, oh, it's really made things come alive. Okay. I'm not begrudging that.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that they're spiritual. I'm just saying I don't feel a compulsion to watch it.
Yeah.
There's no draw for me to watch it. I don't feel like I'm missing anything by not watching it.
On the element of like quality of shooting and things like that, we've talked about this a lot in movies. It is pretty high quality.
Yeah, it looks like it's good, like well made.
For me, I'm fine with it. We have watched seasons 1 through 3. We have not watched the latest. We've actually watched it with our girls. We've watched it with them. We were very clear with them before we watched that this is to some extent fictionalized, to some extent a drama.
They're putting dialogue in the mouths of these people.
So we've often paused and said, okay, girls, just so you know, this may or may not have happened in this way. Or just so you know, I think that the Bible actually speaks about this more. So it's been a great opportunity to just help our girls navigate what is real truth, what is truth, and what on a screen may not be. I'm very aware of different ways of thinking about it in terms of the commandments. I'm also very aware of the controversies. I think some are like the media stuff. It's been blown out of proportion and we've like hooked onto one thing. I agree with you when sinners make something, anything related to Christ, they're going to do something wrong in that sense. I think if you look at it as an opportunity to engage with a material with a level mature head, and understand that it's not scripture.
Yeah.
It can be really useful.
As an illustrative element or as a work of art, I suppose, and I don't mean that like it's high quality art. I just mean as a creative endeavor.
Yes.
I don't oppose it in any regard. It just doesn't appeal to me.
As an example, the woman at the well scene, I actually preached that sermon. My girls were in the room. They heard me preach that sermon. We actually also then watched that episode. And it really helped the girls just understand that this is not just an arbitrary thing written down, that this really did happen. And we were clear with them, you know, I don't know if Christ would have looked like that. I don't know if she would have cried like that. I don't know if the weather was as perfect like that. But they get the concept, which is, this actually really happened. And I do think Dallas Jenkins is doing a pretty decent job of this. If you look at the Jesus movies of old and things like that we've had, I think this is probably a better quality to it. So yeah, I'm fine with it.
In terms of historical accuracy, rootedness, I would recommend it's an animated Jesus movie that came out probably 20 years or so years ago called The Miracle Maker. Did you ever see that one?
Yeah, yeah.
Really enjoy The Miracle Maker. It's a mix of traditional animation and I think claymation.
Yeah.
But don't hear claymation
like
the way
really
we
bad.
Normally see claymation. It's not like Wallace and Gromit or anything. It's more artfully done. But that had like legit New Testament scholars informing it. I think Liam Neeson does the voice of Jesus, but N.T. Wright and others were involved. It's actually really good. We watched that with our girls when they were little. So I like that. So I'm not opposed to the idea. It's just I've never seen an episode, so I don't have a strong opinion.
Yeah.
Zeth also asks where I find the movies that I watch. He says non-Christian movies. Where do you find out about these movies? I've been paying attention to the movie business, Zeth, for, I don't know, since I was a little kid. I've been reading film criticism. So magazines, of course, now things online. I listen to movie podcasts. I love film criticism. So I follow things on social media of film critics and film criticism stuff. But one, you know, if you don't want to do all that, you can go to IMDb and it has a coming soon area. My wife and I subscribe to AMC Stubs. We have the A-list subscription and they have what's coming soon. But you can find out what's coming out just by doing those sorts of things. You can just, you know, put it on to Apple used to have all those trailers of for the movies for the next year and a half on there as well. So there's places you can go if you just Google it. But how I find these like little movies you've never heard of is because I'm kind of nerd level deep on some of these things and have been for years. So
one movie you would recommend off the top of your head?
So we just saw
like rare.
We just saw One Life.
Okay.
A PG movie for grownups. I think I've recommended a couple of those here and there. They don't make a whole lot of those.
Yep.
Stars Anthony Hopkins. It's based on a true story. Maybe you've seen the viral video. It goes out every now and again. The old man on the British television show who's made to sit down and he discovers that everyone in the audience is a child that he had saved during World War II. Yeah. He didn't know this. And it's a very emotional video. This tells the backstory of that story. And Anthony Hopkins plays the, at the time, contemporary 1980s version of this man. But then it also has flashbacks of him as a younger man. A fantastic movie. Solid. It's not, you know, it's not going to win an Oscar, I don't think. But great Hopkins performance. Solid movie. Very emotional. Becky walked out weeping. I walked out going, that was a good movie. And go see it because they don't make grown-up movies with
PG
clean content in them anymore. So we need to support those. And you need to support this podcast. If you like the podcast, give us a good review. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to favorite podcasts. And until next time, and Ross and I got to run to chapel, may Jesus be big in your church.
You've been listening to the For the Church podcast, hosted by Jared Wilson, found online at ftc.co. This resource is brought to you by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where we train leaders for the church.